Greetings and salutations, friends and followers of the Lively Arts. This is Jay Michaels here in the Passion Pit, bringing you one-on-ones with some of the movers, shakers, and arts makers in the indie scene. Working in the indie arena means being able to think out of the box. My two conversations today are just such innovators. The first we have is Nanette Deasy. Nanette and her merry band of extempore thinkers have, for the last 8 years, brought a hybrid of theatrical conventions and improv humor to the masses with the Improvisational Repertory Theater Ensemble. Now, this wacky bunch of actors who can write and present their situation on the spot add a liberal dose of pop culture into the mix for a really hilarious night. Lord knows, it's hard to make me really laugh, and they make me really laugh. Season 8 promises to be a great one. So let's hear all about it from Annette. Hey, let's put her on the spot.
Hi, Jay.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Can you hold for a second?
Sure.
Move someplace. All right. Thanks for holding. I just had to move into an office. I'm at my day job.
Oh my goodness!
Out in the open.
Oh my goodness!
Disturb the other people who are working a bit late.
well, we're going to edit that part out so everyone just knows that you are just doing improvisational work and there's no such thing as a day job.
That's right.
If I'm on the line,
I didn't realize we were recording.
Yeah, really. If I'm on the line, you're on the air. Welcome. One of my very first clients ever, the improvisational. Why am I even saying it? You go right ahead. Tell us all about IRTE.
We are IRTE, which is the friendlier way of saying it, which stands for Improvisational Repertory Theater Ensemble.
Right.
So we are a theater company that does comedy theater, comedy plays based in improvisation. So we sort of meld a bit of traditional theater with everything's completely improvised. So we have some costumes, we have some props, but they're all kind of sort of, I like to think of gutter theater props, the sort of things that you would find at a five and dime store. or my favorite place, Party City, is where I go for a lot of my prop needs.
So, I was going to say, for your fantastical plots, you definitely need that. The last time I was there, your name became was brought home to me because as much as what you did was improvisational, because it's audience participation, as most improvisational thing is, you had this immense use of plot, of character. I thought I was watching a well-written and workshopped play when I was talking to you. Tell us the history. You guys are about 7-8 years old now?
And we're coming into our 8th season. So,
excellent.
Our first was 2012.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So tell us all about how it's been for the last 8 years for you.
Yeah, great. We've really kind of grown and been sort of more comfortable with what we're trying to do. And as you said, yes, although our shows are based in improvisation, we've really moved firmly into very narrative-based shows. So our shows do have story and character and plot. We don't know necessarily what that plot is going to be. Sometimes we don't know what the characters are going to be. Often we'll do shows where we rehearse and workshop characters that have relationships already, and you could plant them down into a world and let everything kind of fly and go and see what develops. How it's grown in the past years. Boy, it seems like a blur. It's gone really fast because it's been so fun. I think we've embraced the idea of being more theatrical and not shying away from that and being goofier, but still having, you know, something that we want to convey and get across. It's not just escapism. A lot of our shows are escapism and silly fun, but we also have strong relationships and characters that we're interested in and want to get to know better.
Do you find reoccurring characters happen almost like in a sitcom sort of way? Do you find that you're resurrecting that particular sort of character again within a new situation?
Oh, yeah. We've done that quite a lot, actually. One of our shows this past year was called Wowie 2, Adventures of a Little Girl Killbot, which was based on a show he had done years before, where we had enjoyed that show from, I forget which season, it was a couple of years before, where we had done this spoof almost of a sitcom about a little girl robot, kind of like Small Wonder from the 80s, if anybody remembers that show. But then we were talking about it, and we were like, well, what would happen if it was the apocalypse? So we brought back most of the same characters, the little girl robot who I played, and said in the apocalypse, and she became kind of a monster.
Interesting.
And it became this really funny story of these people trying to hold on to this sitcom structure, pleasing the robot because they have to learn a lesson, prove their worth prove mankind's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Invariably they would fail and the robot would go out of control. It became not just a sitcom, but this comedy that was very bizarre and absurdist in a way, but also about, I guess, identity and authoritarianism, which was a jump from where we started, where it was just a really goofy sitcom. So we also like bring back characters because they're people that we've enjoyed and we've worked them and like worn their skins and played with each other and improvised off of each other so that we know them a lot better than starting completely from scratch. So even if you put them in different situations and have them dealing with different problems, it's familiar but fresh.
Speaking of familiar but fresh, I've noticed this the first time I worked with you guys, you did something called the Groovy Gang, which looked a little Scooby-Doo-ish to where I was standing. And now we have Small Wonder you mentioned, and I saw a send-up of Secret Agents and of horror movies and all sorts of things. Is this one of my favorite expressions? Are you an accidental genius or are you a genius on purpose? Even better. Is this sort of like a motif of yours? You want to take our pop culture and throw it in the air at us, or was this by accident? You just suddenly came about with these ideas.
I think it's by accident, sort of what we've naturally kind of flowed into. A lot of it is because we're all in the same age and growing up with pop culture, that some of it is just about what do we want to explore and what do we want to play with. Actually, Groovy Gang was another reboot sort of the same characters that we had done years ago before. I guess we had so much fun with them that we wanted to bring them back. Sometimes also we'll try shows in preview. We'll go back to shows that we've done in the past and rework them or rework the characters or make a different structure. The previous time has passed and we have a better understanding of how to play in the form that we do. As far as doing spoofs and pop culture, it's really accidentally what we fall into because we pitch ideas for shows with the main ensemble. We get together and we pitch ideas for shows of what we want to do and we vote together. And it just really comes down to who do you want to play? What sort of things do you want to do? And I think we're kind of on the same page with that.
That's great.
Often we do.
Yeah, you guys always work as a single unit. Whenever I watch it, it's not like there's a star. It's like everybody is just one great, big, hilarious machine, which is wonderful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, ensemble work is very important to us. It's in our name.
Sure.
it's much better when I think everybody is carrying the weight. Especially, I don't think you can have anyone be like the main star when you do, especially a work that's so based in improvisation.
Sure.
Because everybody has to be really active, really listening. Otherwise, shows can quickly fall apart and go south.
There's no rehearsal necessarily. Of course, there's some form of preparation, but.
There's rehearsal. We rehearse. But as I said, we don't have set dialogue. We don't have a set plot. We have we have a structure and a world that we've developed, and often characters that we develop, but in order to get used to that world, the structure and who we're playing in it, and how to play with each other and understand each other's shorthand, the performance, we do rehearse together.
So this is more, that's more the theater background, if you will. You are building these very complex characters, and then you're letting them out of the nest at whatever situation the audience throws at you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you have to, we work together to a certain point, and it's maybe not as much rehearsal as we would love, just because of the realities of budget and space in New York and time. So,
yep.
So maybe we don't have that much rehearsal for each show, but we do get together and do rehearse.
Exactly. Just now, is it? I have two audience questions for you. One, when you turn to an audience and say, "Okay, name these things. Tell us where you want to put us." When you basically invite the audience to create the show, how do you feel right before they give you their answers? Is there that moment of, "Oh my God, please don't tell me you're putting me in Donald Trump's living room or something, please"?
You know, I'm usually very excited because the audience always comes up with much better things than I'm going to come up with. Because it also takes out the pressure of anticipation. So you're not anticipating like, oh, I need to do this really interesting thing to please the audience because I've already planned this in my mind. It's like, you know, you just have the second and it just happens. So it takes the pressure off. Often, though, if you get like... I mean, yeah, we always have, like, the audiences have been very good. We've been very lucky with suggestions. But, yeah, you're always going to get an odd suggestion.
There you go.
But you can make something out of nothing. You can usually, like, what was the example that you gave? Donald Trump's
living room or bathroom or whatever.
That sounds like a great suggestion, actually.
Actually, Donald Trump's bathroom at 3:00 in the morning with him on Twitter. There you go. And scene. A big question in terms of audience, which I've always been curious about. You tour now. When I first met you, you were New York based completely. You're still New York based, but you go everywhere. You're across the country these days.
Yeah, we love it. We love going to a lot of fringe festivals, or what we're very excited about right now. It's great. It's really fun because you go on this. It's like going on performance vacation with your friends.
I like that. I like that. Your busman's holiday. I like that.
It is. You go and you get to perform in front of a whole new audience in theaters that are really terrific sometimes, or not terrific, but interesting and challenging. Or actually, no, I take that back. Almost all the places we've had have like great venues, like with new people, and you experience and you see other performers from other parts of the country, and you see what they're doing, because especially with the fringe festivals, they're very out there and unique and, you know, on the fringe.
Of course.
Very commercial. Yeah. So you get a lot of ideas about stuff that you might want to play with and try. And we also, I have to admit, there is part of us also that chooses a lot of festivals to go to based on like, oh, I'd love to go to New Orleans this year based on the city that they're in.
That's not bad. You decide where your vacation is and you go perform there. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great thing to do. It's my favorite thing to do.
On that topic, my other question in terms of audience, how's humor across the country? Do you find that you have to almost I'm in New Orleans. There's a very New Orleans sense of humor here. I'm in Seattle. There's a very Seattle sense of humor. You don't just take New York and put it somewhere else. What does that have to do for you in terms of your preparation of being in another place, another sensibility, another sense of humor?
Well, I don't know. I think humor is, there is a common language, a commonality. A lot of places we haven't gone internationally yet, so we'll see how that is.
Yeah. Tell me how they are in France. But in the meanwhile, yes.
But meanwhile, I don't think we have very New York centric shows, and a lot of them aren't actually set in New York. We have we've got musical guests with us who've been part of the show, and sometimes they'll want to do something a little more local. But we pretty much, I don't think that it really changes too much from place to place. Although sometimes when you're in a different city or more relaxed city, people going to a fringe festival, they're very open about what they're going to see. So I've never really thought about changing it to suit the particular locale that we've gone to perform at. I wonder if I should think about that. I've never thought it up.
Not so much changing. I mean, do you find that a joke that gets uproarious laughs in New York only gets a titter somewhere else and vice versa? That you think, okay, a throwaway line is going to get a standing ovation somewhere and you didn't even realize it? Do you think that's like a regional thing, or is that just, okay, humor is a roll of the dice? Do you think it's location specific in any way?
I don't think necessarily location specific, because we get that here in New York from night to night.
That's true. There you go.
So you never know. You never know, like, what the joke that you think or the situation that's going to be like, oh, this is going to kill. This is going to be amazing. Might be just crickets. And then something that's a throwaway that you hadn't even thought about goes over gangbusters. You never know. And then it could be vice versa for the following night. It's also, there's a really interesting thing with audiences also, I think, that audiences feed each other. So if you get one or two people who are really into the show, that sort of spreads throughout the audience. If you get a small house or maybe people who are really quiet, they may be, other people maybe enjoy the show a lot, but they don't want to expose themselves
by
being too vocal. Which I get, I've been in that situation as an audience member myself, where I've like quietly enjoyed a show, but didn't feel like the anonymity of like being surrounded by people who are very vocal.
It's
so
funny.
You never know what's going on with the audience.
It's funny you say that.
You can't predict them.
Years ago, I was at a stand-up comedy night, and there was one comedian that I thought was hilarious. I just didn't feel like laughing, so I'm just smiling. And he looked down at me at one point and said, "You can laugh anytime you want, buddy." And I was like, "Dude, I'm having a good time." And I was like, "Wow, I didn't realize I insulted him just by mildly appreciating his work."
I mean, then there was your evening blown. You know?
Yeah, there you go.
I like the guy.
I went home angry. Improvisation itself. Now I'm a very old man. I remember when it was on television. I remember when Chicago City Limits was the place to be. I remember when improv was totally out. Do you find improv is still a big thing out there? Or do you think it's joined the theatrical milieu somewhat? How is improv as an art form, if you will, in terms of your audiences? How do they, is it still popular like it used to be?
I think there's still like a huge remove from theater, from most of theater in New York. I can't speak to other cities because it's very different. I mean, improv, like for instance, in Chicago is a completely different thing, and in LA, I believe. And I'm not very familiar with those two markets, but I know in New York, it has grown considerably. It was for a long
Interesting.
Time, it was absolutely not known at all. For some reason, it never quite gained a foothold for a long time, I think until maybe like the 2000s. I mean, they had improv. There were improv theaters such as Chicago City Limits and Gotham City Improv that existed in the 80s. But I think it started with getting more interest as people were coming from Chicago and setting up things here, like in the late 90s, and then 2000 with the UCB, with UCB coming and the Pit, etc. But I still think that it hasn't quite... There still seems to be this weird remove between regular theater that you would go see, whether it's mainstream, whether it's fringe, whether it's indie, independent in New York, with improvisation. I don't 100% know why that is. And that was one of my reactions with creating. So I was reacting to that. That was partly when I started, when I created Erty, that I wanted to take kind of the best of both worlds. The theatricality, the fun, the costumes, the props, the whole theatrical experience of coming in, having the story told that you get with a lot of theater, and combine that with the spontaneity, the fun, the unpredictableness of improv. I felt like with improv, it wasn't allowing itself the fun of theatricality. I mean, it's changed and it's evolved since then, I believe, since we started a bit. But it just felt like it was, to be honest, some improv, I'm not going to say who, but some people who are advisors thought, like, militantly almost, that you can never have costumes. You can never do big characters. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody felt like that, but there was this, I think, this, you know, fashion of that, that I was basically saying, well, that sort of also, that frees some people, but that limits a lot of shows. And it limits it, I think, to the enjoyment of the audience.
Sure.
Or at least, and it definitely isn't as interesting to me. So things have changed, but it's still, I feel like people still kind of remove, like, separate improv and theater a lot in ways that I don't think is necessary.
Well, it sounds like you've started a trend. It sounds like you've started the trend that hopefully will continue, that improv is very much a part of the theatrical community.
Yeah.
And that you can go to one and the other. And in your case, you can go to both at the same time. You're going to be 8 years old. So where are you going to be when you're 10? At the 10th anniversary, the big 10th anniversary season, what do you envision?
Oh, boy, I would like, what do I envision? I would love, like, longer runs of our shows. I would like more traveling with the shows. I'd like a longer season. We'll see. Taking more choice, more chances, better everything. I'm very optimistic. Everything will be much better.
How do you feel about putting it on television? I remember improvs used to be on television a great deal. How do you feel about it appearing on TV shows and just even video programming, even something like YouTube, if you will?
Oh, I would love that. I think that would be great. Yeah. I mean, if somebody who is wants to help us out with that project, that would be terrific.
Well, there you are, listeners.
It would be fabulous. Yeah.
If any of you have a TV station and you need an improv program. Well, I think you guys have been marvelous. I have followed you happily for all 8 years, and I thought it's absolutely inspired that you're taking the theater and making it improv, because in the end, that's what theater is. You know, no matter how many weeks, months, years you rehearse a project, the curtain goes up and it's a brand new show.
Yeah, and honestly, nobody should say theater is a constantly evolving art form, and it needs to move and evolve and grow, and nobody should say improv is just this, that, and the other. Theater is just this, that, and the other. I think that we should be experimenting and melding all different forms of theater together.
Terrific.
That's what I hope we do more of.
And I hope to see lots of it with all of your names on it. Nanette, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. It has been great to hear from you. Looking forward to the next season. I will tell our listeners where to look out for you guys, where to find Irti. And where they can go to laugh uproariously when they do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay.
I will talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye.
They had an audience participation one night when they were at the Midtown International Theater Festival. And as luck would have it, I was sitting in the front row. And guess who got to be one of the guest improvers that night? It is a lot harder than it looks. There are pictures to prove that point, and I won't tell you where they are on Facebook. Hey, I wonder if the Improvisational Repertory Theater Ensemble plays video games.
Do you like video games? Do you like to read?
All right, guys, I know that those two things usually don't go so well together, but my new book, The Minds Behind the Games, Interviews with Cult and Classic Video Game Developers, is kind of like an ESPN 30 for 30 collection of interviews with some of the coolest creators in video game history. We're talking iconic games, Deus Ex, Mortal Kombat, Wasteland, NBA Jam, not so iconic, E.T., Night Trap, indie games, Pro Wrestling X, Towerfall. If you love video games, you will love my book. If you know nothing about video games and want to get in the know, read my book. It's available wherever fine books are sold: Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, and of course my site, patrickhickeyjr.com. It's an awesome book. I had a ton of fun writing it. And simply put, if you want to get in the know and you want to find out stuff that's not even on Wikipedia, check it out. You won't regret it.
So Patrick Hickey is the editor-in-chief of ReviewFix, one of the leading pop culture sites. He is also a professor of journalism at Kingsborough College. Pretty smart. Speaking of pretty smart, now we're going to talk to Laris Macario. Laris has taken on one of Shakespeare's most difficult pieces and one of the most definitive of war plays, Henry V. Now what he's done, he's added some ancient weaponry with some modern clothing, then some historical references with some allusions to the current political climate. And he's presenting it all at one of the last bastions of the original off-Broadway movement, the American Theater of Actors. He is bringing us a new version of one of Shakespeare's most recognizable plays. Okay, Laris, once more unto the breach.
Hello.
Laris Macario.
This is he.
This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the line, you're on the air.
All right, Jay. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. I'm doing well.
No, you're not. You're doing crazy. How? So let me see. You had some time on your hands, so you decided to tackle one of Shakespeare's most enigmatic and most powerful characters for a weekend at one of New York's most legendary theaters. Gee, imagine if you had more time on your hands.
Yeah, I did all that.
Now, I know the show just started rehearsal, like a couple of days ago, yes?
We started rehearsal the 23rd, which was last week.
Okay.
And, so we've been running. We had our first read-through on Sunday, which was extraordinary to see the entire cast there. It was 20-some-odd people in the same room reading and acting and emoting and, you know, doing the whole thing and bringing their sauce to the party.
So aside from taking one of Shakespeare's most powerful characters, aside from running the production company that's doing it, aside from playing the part, you have a Broadway director in there, and you decide to have over 20 people in the show. You know, it's so much easier to just like walk off a pier if you really want to kill yourself. Let me tell you. Wow, man.
Yeah.
How's it going? How's everything going with it?
Oh God, it's there are so many blessings. I can't even count them, man.
And, oh, that's great.
And with each step, with each move, we make closer and closer to the show. It gets better and better, and more people come out of the woodworks to support and to give money and to buy tickets, to lend a hand, to offer their services. And there's so many smart, bright, motivated people that are involved with this production. There's no way I could have ever done this by myself, obviously. So that's been the greatest thing. I mean, that's been the greatest surprise, is how many people, once they find out what you're doing Shakespeare, what you're doing Henry V, what can I do to help? They've been really helpful. It's been great.
That is terrific. I'm so glad to hear that. How did it get started? Did you just wake up one morning and scream once more into the breach and the rest is history? Or what made you say it's time for this play?
It actually started as an acting exercise. One of my goals last year was I wasn't really happy where my career was. And I said, well, I got to jumpstart this thing. And I said, well, I always wanted to play Henry V. I actually have gone through the entire canon and written pieces and roles that I really wanted to play, and I highlighted all of his lines, and one of my goals was I'm going to learn all of his lines. Just as an acting exercise, you know, jumpstart it and do it. And then I went to Paris, and I went to Paris, and I was just inspired and in awe of how beautiful everything is. And I said, God, this is a city full of artists. This is a city full of people who create. Not only the city was a city, but it's also a work of art. I said, I got to do this. And so I came back home. I started calling people up. I said, hey, you want to do Henry V? People were like, yeah, I would love to. And then I woke up the next day and I had a bunch of mail messages with people like, are you still doing the play? I said, oh, yeah, I guess I am still doing the play. You know, like you do a thing like that. You sort of make like a little bet with yourself, a little wager, and you say, oh, you know, let me put all some feelers out there. And people were really enthused. So one thing led to another, man, and all the pieces started to come drop right into place, man, with each move that I made. So I just had to keep going with it. And it actually was supposed to happen in December. Logistically, it couldn't work out. But 2/3 of the cast told me, I'm going to learn my lines. Call me when you're ready.
Wow.
And when people tell you that, you got to do it, because it's what you got to do. I mean, these people are on board. And so I found a way. And now we're rehearsing. We're going to be in the space rehearsing next week that we're going to be showing in the American Theater of Actors. And that's how it happens.
This is almost art imitating life, really, because this is you screamed today is St. Crispin's Day and they all come running. So this is really great. Well, this is the first for your theater company too. Yes, this is inaugural voyage.
This is the first Shakespeare full. This is the first full production. So, I've done a digital short. I did what was called the Shakespeare Monologue Slam, which is a Shakespeare monologue competition, which is a huge hit. That was the summer and a half ago. So I guess the summer of 2017. And, this is definitely the biggest thing I've ever taken on.
Wow.
By far.
now, the Shakespeare monologue competition, so your company's multimedia, you did things in terms of not film work, but video work.
So a couple of things. So I've done the digital short, which is really, really successful, called Pheromones. You can see it on YouTube and look it up. I've also done the Shakespeare Slam. I've also sold a television show to a network that I can't talk about. I signed an NDA, so.
Uh-huh.
So just know that that happened. We're multimedia, man. I mean, I'm in pre-production now for a short film that I wrote as well. So,
do you think that's necessary? You're the second company I've spoken to that when I asked them about their season. They gave me their webisodes, their independent film, their independent play, this slam, this poetry, this whatever. Do you think that's the new wave for the theater company? It's not just about, you know, three or four plays a year. It's about just the total multimedia package. Do you think that's where we're headed?
Yeah, I think it feeds off itself. I mean, you look at the internet, obviously, and Instagram and all the social media stuff, and everything, so much stuff is online. And if you want to do theater, you got to go and, you know, the majority of the theater crowd is 50, 60, 70, for whatever reason it is. I mean, sometimes theater is really expensive. If you want to do theater and keep it going, you have to go where that demographic is living, right? And so, the stuff that I do, new media, you know, the content that I do with new media, the short film, that all feeds into the theater company. The theater company feeds into the short film. So it all really becomes, well, in essence, eventually it'll become vertically, you know, integrated. But yeah, I think you do have to pay respect to the new media, because it can only help you.
It's kind of like that's where you're going to find your audience. People don't pick up, you know, the listings every Wednesday like they did when I was your age. It's now, you know, what can they find on their phones? What is their what's exactly on the side of their Facebook page that they're going to pay attention to?
That's it too. That's absolutely 100%. And a lot of people don't go to. I think a lot of younger people don't go to theater because it's not to them. It doesn't appeal. It's not as cool, but it's really cool. I mean, you do Shakespeare and it's better. You produce Shakespeare. It's better than probably anything you can produce, in my opinion, right, in the theater.
Why?
And it's universal. And why? Because it's, one, it's universal. Two, these are myths and these are ideas and these are problems that human beings are still dealing with today. For example, right, take Hamlet. It's not about a Danish prince. It's about procrastination. It's about doing the right thing. It's about, you know, standing up for what you actually believe in and now allowing somebody else to come in and take essentially your lunch from you, right? I mean, you can read it as what the story is, but really what it is anybody can watch. We are all Hamlet and Hamlet is us. So the same thing with Henry, it really does run parallel with what I'm doing with my production company. I don't have those sorts of connections. My father's a mailman, my mother's a maid, you know, both immigrants. I'm first generation American, but I'm doing this thing and creating this production company and hopefully paying homage to them and my people and the theater community and Thespis thousands of years ago. And by doing this thing, which is very, very difficult. And sometimes it's very, very challenging, but I believe that it's for the better, right? And not just for me, but for the posterity. And that's really what Henry's trying to do. And so you can watch Henry and say, oh, this is a war play. You can watch Henry and say, this is a play about an individual who believes in himself and wants to make their stamp on the world. And anyone can identify with that. Anyone. Nobody, you don't have to be in England, you know, in the 14th century to identify with that.
For
if
sure.
You're trying to do any, yeah. If you're trying to grow and come out of your own shell and really, you know, and leave something behind, watch the play and you'll see it.
How are you in your production? Now, what you said really was so spot on. I give you such props for that. It's it used to be the good old days where, okay, you went to conservatory and you have your master's degree in this, and okay, you've studied in England for 10 years, so now you can go do theater. But you're saying the common man can stand on that stage now next to anybody. This is for everyone. Theater is for everyone, if you will.
Well, I mean, this is the thing is people come in contact with Shakespeare, and because of the language, right, the poetic realism, they assume it's only for people that are of a certain class, a certain education level, a certain socioeconomic status, and but Shakespeare wrote for the common man. He wasn't writing for the king. Jesus Christ, the king was actually behind the play.
Right.
So that everybody could look at him, right? Like, what he was writing for was the groundling, the people on the ground floor, the people that paid a penny to go watch the play and threw things on the stage when they didn't like it and hooped and hollered. And, you know, you think about all the body jokes in Shakespeare. You think about all the blood and the gore and these really insane. I mean, you like the porn violence, for example, that you see in movies. Shakespeare was doing that 400 years ago.
Oh, sure.
And so it's not written for the everyman, but for whatever reason, because of the chasm between the theater and the normal, right, like the populace, they don't understand that. And I think that the theater community unfortunately perpetuates that, because when we speak of Shakespeare, these classical plays, we speak of it in almost these, like, I don't know, these very, I don't know the word that I'm looking for, but you understand what I'm saying? When you speak
completely.
Of it as if, like, people that speak about art, fine art, you know, connoisseurs of fine art, I don't understand what they're talking about. I just know that the piece moves me. That's all the audience speaks about. That's all the audience understands, is that it moves them. And that's our job as theater artists. It isn't to wave our finger at them and tell them this is the exact way that you do Shakespeare, and if you don't understand Shakespeare, you must be a Neanderthal, because that's not true. It's for everyone.
You bring up a really valuable point. I know someone who at one point, and he lives in the South, and someone was talking to him once about hush puppies and certain foods and whatever, saying how wonderful they are and whatever, and he smirked at them and said, you know, that's all we can afford was to take corn, was to take potatoes. That was all we had, and you're calling it a delicacy. And in a way, it's the same thing you're giving with Shakespeare. The wealthy have taken it, and because the language is antiquated, they're saying, well, we need to study it, whatever, and make it nice and dusty. You're absolutely right. If Shakespeare was alive today, he'd write James Bond films, horror movies, and porn.
That's all he would write.
Oh, of course.
That's all he would write. I mean, if you think about it, you know, like, but in all fairness, I used to be the same way. Until I really started to look at the work closely and realized that the sonnets, they would pay him for the sonnets, right? The sonnets were like comics. It was like Archie Comics. It was like, look, they knew he was going to make X shillings for this thing. Here's a couple sonnets here, whatever. He paid his rent. He did what he had to do. Went right back and wrote plays. And
of course,
was writing plays at a clip, man. He wrote like five or six of these things in a year. It was, you know, so he wasn't thinking about being the greatest playwright in the English language. He was just trying to pay his rent. But the audience liked.
I was going to say, without the notion of copy machines or anything like that, it was like he never put down his pen for 10 years. So, yeah, that's a really good point.
No. And that's great that you wrote, that you said that number, because there really was basically essentially like a decade. Especially from like time he was like 35, 40, when the bulk of his stuff just started coming out.
Yep.
And then he passed away in his, I think it was early 50s, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right. It was like an explosion in his brain. It's just everything had to come out. He was, well, they say the same thing about Mozart. So, yeah, it's basically the same thing.
You know what I think? I think what happens is you go and you mess up and you mess up and you fail and you fail and you fail. It's a hot mess. You're the first 10 or 15 years you're doing anything. And then all of a sudden, all the little wires in your brain, whoop, they connect. And then something happens and you really start taking it up. I mean, you see it in Hollywood. You ever notice, like, when the actors, I don't really know how it works for actresses, but definitely for the male actors, which is what I use to model my career after. It's the late 30s, early 40s, is all of a sudden they're like, who's this Tom Hardy? Who's this whatever? But Tom Hardy's been doing this thing for 15 years, 20 years, whatever it is. It's just now we're all like, who's this guy?
If we really dedicated ourselves to looking at early careers, you would see so many brilliant actors, tiny roles, walk-ons, terrible movies, terrible plays. You're right. They did crap for decades. Yeah. And all of a sudden somebody said, you know, they're pretty good. And suddenly now they're a star. You're absolutely right.
What are you
doing in your Henry? What are you doing in your play that is making it accessible to all audiences? So let's say your audience is filled with the common man. What are they going to walk away with? What are you doing in it that's going to make them say, wow, that's for me?
Mary Lou, our director, is adamant about making sure that we're understood. And she was very, you know, there's a lot of technique that goes into the work. There's breath work and consonant work and fricatives that you have to, you know, you have to pronounce and whatever. But she says, look, it sounds really nice, but I don't understand you. If I don't understand you, I'm bored to death. And I said, you know what? 110%. So I'm glad that she from the jump is already like, guys, it may great. You might sound good, especially to the trained ear. But if the audience doesn't get it, then why are you up here? And that's helped me in terms of my approach to the work.
Excellent. And visually, from what I understand, it's not modern dress, but it's sort of like this euphemistic sort of clothing that everyone's wearing.
So it's modern dress alluding to the time period.
Okay.
Right? So there are pieces. When I mean modern dress, I mean they're very like blacks and grays. It's not going to be. We're not out there in Chuck Taylors and Jordans and what I mean, like Air Maxes. We're not doing that. It's just going to be black or dark gray or charcoal, and then we're going to have little pieces that are going to indicate, okay, I'm the king, I'm the prince, I'm the dauphin, I'm the this, I'm the that character, right? And so that also actually, I think, lends itself. There's something to be said for the audience filling in the gaps.
I was about to say that. Good.
Costumes are great. Costumes are fantastic. But if you really, the audience is smart, man. And they have a very vivid imagination. And if you just give them a little taste, their imagination goes off, man. They imagine, you don't have to necessarily lay it all on a silver platter for them. And what ends up happening sometimes in productions I've seen have been a part of, the costuming or the lights or the set overpowers the story.
Completely.
Right? And who cares if all that stuff, you see it in film though. You see it in film with the CGI and all that stuff. It's like, great, but this story didn't move me. It doesn't mean anything. So why the $100 million budget if the story didn't matter? Right. If I don't feel anything at the end of it,
that's also supplying its own competition, because there are TV shows like Outlander and The Crown and Victoria where the costumes are so flawless. You are looking at that time period completely. To try to replicate that on stage without $1 million budget, you're giving yourself your own competition. Considering the production scheme of your company, if you will, you're almost allowing a sort of a surreal multimedia. You're right. Every actor is a screen. If they're just in black and white, the audience can project the image on there, just a sash or a crown or whatever. Now they know who they're playing, and let the audience put the clothing on them, if you will. So you're giving the audience so much more to work with in such a situation.
Yeah. And the other thing is too, as an actor, it forces me. I am compelled to make sure that I'm properly telling the story with my body and my voice.
Good. You don't have to say, well, never mind, I'm wearing complete velvet with a crown and a cape, so I'm in good shape. It has to be you that creates it in our minds.
Yeah, you guys got to get it. You got to say, okay, this guy's the king, right?
That's great.
And if you don't feel that, if you don't suspend disbelief, it's my job. It's my fault. It's on my shoulders. Now, that's a lot of pressure, but you know, why take on Henry V if you're not going to take on the pressure?
Good for you. There's an old expression, and they use it for musicals. They always say he came out humming the costumes.
So yeah, you are making sure that we're going to see the actors and not the shoes. What's next? I don't think you're retiring. So what's next? What's the next thing you're doing?
So I'm in pre-production for a short film titled Trespasses, about infidelity. A gentleman, finds the wallet of the man cheating, who his wife is cheating on him with at his house, and brings the wallet back to him. So we see what plays out. Yeah. After the confrontation, well, we'll see what happens. You know what I mean? Like what would happen if, you know, we've all dated people or been afraid of that. I mean, I think that's most people's biggest fear in a relationship. But what would happen if you were actually confronted, not with the person that you're in a relationship, but with the individual who your person you're in a relationship with is cheating? And so, it was something that happened to someone that was close to me, and I'm interested in exploring that. And I really like, and it's a film. I like those old school films. I don't know if you've ever seen The Professional, or if you've ever seen, you know, those movies that are very, very, like it's not necessarily The Professional, maybe like Quentin Tarantino, where, you know, they're all around the table having a conversation.
It's a character study. Right? And the films are a character
study. Yeah, it's a character study. Yeah. So it's the drama that plays out in close quarters, which could potentially at any moment turn into a violent situation. What happens and how do these people navigate this world? And I love those films, and they're difficult to make, but they're also fun to make. And when done right, you're left breathless at the end of it.
That's the hybrid, because these character studies are sitting around a table. They're one step away from being a play. So you're combining both worlds on that way.
Yeah. I like things like that. I mean, I'm also in pre-production for a pirate epic I'm writing. Not Pirates of the Caribbean. It's not going to be Disney-fied. You know, God
don't you dare.
Disney. I wish they're, you know, they're Disney, and they're Disney for a reason, but it's more about the golden age of piracy, which is roughly the early to mid 18th century.
Right.
And I'm Dominican, that was a very, very pivotal moment in the colonization of the New World, specifically in Latin America. Because that was right after I believe it was the Treaty of Ryswick, which is 1698,
right.
Essentially dissolved many of the Spanish empires, and England was coming up as a naval power. And so it was just, that's why piracy exploded, was because it was up in flux. Like the European powers weren't yet organized enough to combat it. So there was a lot of gold, a lot of silver, a lot of spices, a lot of stuff. And it was a crazy time.
And this touches you, considering once again you're looking at your from a roundabout way, you're looking at your heritage, you're looking at something that means important to you.
Well, Santo Domingo, which is the capital of the Dominican Republic, was the first colony in the New World. Obviously, it was a Spanish colony, and it was for a long time the seat of Spain. The Viceroy of Spain was there until it moved to Peru and to various other places. But it was also the place that it was also left. So when Havana became the main port in the north of the Spanish Empire in the New World, right? One of the main ports. The Dominican Republic was essentially, it wasn't the Dominican Republic before, it was Title Quisqueya, hence the name of my production company, it became sort of a Wild West, you know? And they were, the story goes, there were cimarrones, which are called wild animals, which are half indigenous, half Africans, that were escaped up to the mountains, bred. And what they would do is they would have guerrilla attacks on the Spanish, like the Spanish battalions patrolling the island and whatever. And so it led to a lot of turmoil on the island itself, but just throughout the entire empire. So yeah, basically it's a story about our collective history, especially Latinos, because nobody talks about colonialism. I don't understand it. Like if you're in America, if you're in the Americas, like that's such a rife period to talk about. The 16th, 17th and 18th centuries are just like rich with all this history in the New World, but they never make movies about it. Okay.
Well, because somewhere someone's going to point and say, whose fault is this? And everyone's afraid that it's going to point at them. So they only pick the nicest of subjects, I think.
Well, let me explain. Look, I mean, if we're all going to heal from whatever it is that we need to heal from, we got to look at the dragon. You got to look at it in the face and say, this is the history. This is what happened. let's not get emotional about it. Let's write a story and see if we can move forward. And yeah, I think you're 110% right about that. There are a lot of issues people don't want to tackle because, God forbid, you know, they want to whatever. For example, another one is they don't ever talk about the Japanese internment camps in America. Why? That was a major part of the war in World War II, but they don't want to talk about this for whatever reason. Fine.
Well, they did once. George Takei put a Broadway show up regarding it, and it seemed to disappear afterwards because enough people got nervous. Enough people were afraid someone would say, well, what happened here? And they just didn't want to have to answer.
But I don't think the society can move forward unless we – and I'm not talking about pointing the finger, right? Because history is a very complex thing. And if you go back far enough, everybody was messed with. Everybody was enslaved. Everybody was a victim on some level. Well, if you go by the common narrative, right, it isn't necessarily the case. And Hollywood, by its very nature, I think, and I think our industry in general, it is sometimes driven by a lot of fear, right? Fear of retribution, fear of people not liking it, fear of being sued, fear of never working again, fear of whatever, that we are sometimes afraid, there's that word again, to actually look at ourselves truthfully, right?
I think
if people
sat down and said, okay, that was then, what happened then? Whatever the outcome is, wherever we're speaking, I see this now because the way people are talking about Christopher Columbus, the way people are talking about Thanksgiving, Abraham Lincoln is coming under fire these days for philosophies which we didn't know he had. They so deified him as well. I think if we just sat back and said, okay, that was 300 years ago, 400, 500 years ago, let's fix it. Instead of saying, well, it's not my fault, it's not my people's fault, it's not whatever, let's just say, okay, what can we do about this? I think we'd be in a much better place in the world. I think we'd be a much better world.
I agree. But the thing also to remember is these were individuals that were products of their time.
Right? Thank you.
People
yes.
are going to look back at us and say, you know what was wrong with those people, right? It happens in every generation, it happens in every epoch, it happens in every century, whatever time frame you want to use. And for me personally, right, Christopher Columbus, many of his cohorts instituted one of the greatest genocides in human history with the indigenous peoples of the New World. True, right? That happened, right? But how long am I going to be angry at Columbus for, really? Because the other side of the coin is, if it wasn't for Columbus, I wouldn't be here today.
There you go.
Because in essence, I was the result of that, the colonization of the New World. I am a person of mixed ethnic background, right? So I look at these things and say, well let's talk about it, man. Let's actually look at history honestly and say, look, this is a thing and this is how it happened. If you really want to move forward and to fix things, then you can show exactly what the genesis of it, what the germ of it was, explore the situation itself and figure out how they cannot happen again.
Right.
But by just pointing the finger and getting angry and getting upset at things, and to me, it doesn't make any sense.
There's no such thing as pure good and pure evil. There's no such thing.
Never. The heart of between good and evil runs through the line between good and evil runs through the heart of every man. That is a truism without a shadow of a doubt. And we get into dangerous waters when we point at other people and say that person is bad and I could never do that thing. The mere fact that you can recognize that thing is bad means that somewhere inside of you, it exists.
There you go.
You understand?
Because if you can identify the evil, then you know what it is. Yes.
If you can identify bad in someone else, it means you can identify it in yourself. You can identify it in yourself.
Of course.
I know that's not a very popular opinion to have, and that's not
really
something we like to think about. But look, we're all part of the human race, and under certain circumstances, who knows what we would do? It doesn't condone these things, but it's an honest way of looking at it, and it's also the best way to prevent it. If you know that you potentially could be capable of it. This is another thing with Henry V, right? Because Henry goes, right? He goes into France and he essentially conquers France. But does he have a rightful claim to the throne? To the English, he's a hero, but to the French, he's a tyrant.
That's right. That's right.
If you flip it around and you make Charles the I think it's the fifth or the sixth, Charles, when you switch it around and now you have this marauding tyrant coming into your land. And essentially laying waste this beautiful, rich place, which is France, then it becomes a very different story. So then what's the perspective and what story are we telling? And let's examine it truthfully. And he even asks those questions. He asks those questions of himself, and other people do.
History is always written by the winners.
It's always written by the winners.
If you look at Shakespeare, the main topic here, Shakespeare, I always thought was clairvoyant because he said, okay, here's the villain today, but they're not going to remain that way. That's why the Merchant of Venice, Shylock, is this villain. But when he says, when he has his famed speech about hath not a Jew hands, eyes, senses, dimensions, etc., he's basically saying, okay, you don't like me, but am I wrong? And then you have Othello and you have Jason in Titus Andronicus. Here are two Moors, two African-American characters. And again, they are fighting for their beliefs. You could say that they're doing wrong, but they're only fighting for what belongs to them. So I think Shakespeare always said, okay, wait a minute. Let's see what happens in 100 years. Let me write them both sides of the coin.
I also think, yes, and 110%, what was brilliant about those characters is, if we take the racial element out of it, it's the demonization of the outside.
Yeah. Right?
And the human being's proclivity to demonize the outsider because they are afraid. Because we're tribal animals, right? And
of course.
You get enough people of the same ilk or of the same thought pattern and they become a tribe. And then anybody who doesn't think or look or walk or believe in the things that they believe in becomes the enemy.
Yeah.
Right. And so it just changes. I think that it was relevant specifically for Europe because Europe tended to demonize the Jews, right? Especially during that period. And
of
then
course.
Also demonize the others, which were the blacks or the browns or the Orients or whatever they decided was the other for them.
Anybody wasn't from there. That's as simple as that.
Anybody who wasn't lily white. Essentially,
thank you.
Right. However, right. But if you take that situation, right, and you put that in China or somewhere else, then all of a sudden the lily white guy becomes the Jew or the black actor, the other. And so it's a human story. Human beings do this stuff, and they do it. We just so happens we happen to be telling the story of a Western European, and so that's the lens that we're seeing it through. And so most of my work, almost all of my work, now that I'm realizing it, right, because things become clear as you do them.
Of course.
They show them, right? The more you do something, the more you realize, oh, okay, like Carl Jung was talking about, you essentially spiral closer to your true self. If you keep going through, if you keep leading a just life or the life that you know, you're listening to the voice inside of you, right? The more I go with this, I'm always examining that. The hero-tyrant dichotomy, the sort of placed in another situation, how would this individual be perceived, and how would that individual act in that situation? Right. I love stories. I've read a story once about America being colonized instead of Western Europe, but by Egypt, and it flipped me out. So it's essentially supposed to take place in the middle 19th century, but they're using the Arabic calendar, so it's the year 12 X, Y, and Z. And with the slaves, right, these enslaved people are the British. Not the British. Sorry, well, people from the British Isles and also from Ireland, but mostly the Irish. So it flips this thing on its head and it's saying, what if things were reversed? How would people interact? And they'd interact the exact same way.
Of course.
That thing is universal, that, oh, there's the other, that is their enemy, that person has to be subdued, that individual has to be put down. We can't deal with that. It's scaring us. So we got to kill it, or we got to enslave it, or we got to run away from it, or we got to block it from coming into our thing.
Wow.
Those are the things that I like to deal with. Those are the projects that really speak to me. For me, what I seek to do in my work is to bring people in, right? And to grab them by their core and shake them and remind them that they're alive and that we're all much more alike than we are different. And that pressed with that and then presented with a certain situation, how would they react? Right. And that's what I think, you know, Shakespeare's thing Shakespeare's line, Hamlet's advice to the players, show virtue her own features, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, his form and pressure. Right. These things, they're not about race. They're not about gender. They're not about socioeconomic class. They're things that every single person has to deal with. The beauty inside of them, the scorn inside of them, and eventually everybody succumbs to Father Time.
And that's why Shakespeare endures. So where I started this conversation was saying that you've decided to do this amazing feet. And of course, so most people want the audience to be entertained and enlightened when they leave. No, you would like your production to change the world. Good. So apparently that's covered all the way through.
Well, if I can change an individual, and most importantly, change myself for the better, then I think that I've done my job. I don't know if I can change the world. Who knows?
I have a feeling you're going to change it one show at a time. I have every faith in listening to you speak about the world and about Shakespeare and your culture and everything like that. I definitely see that within you. I think that's terrific.
I appreciate it.
Laris, thank you so much for chatting with me. This has been enlightening and wonderful, and I look forward to you going once more onto the breach at the American Theater of Actors in February. I'll tell all our listeners exactly where they go. I'll put a link on the episode so that everybody knows how to order tickets and to absolutely sell out that theater to see a one-of-a-kind production. Thank you so much for chatting. My absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I will talk to you soon.
As well. You as well. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Speaking of legendary spaces, look for podcasts about the new play, Moral Support, written by Bill Considine, and it's a drama about a family torn apart by cancer at the original Medicine Show Theater. And one of the first plays about millennial angst, The Floor is Lava, a new production at the legendary La Mama Experimental Theater. And look for, wait for it, a full episode with the cast of I'm So High. Listen to Reverend Mary weed through witty stories about vintage songs, a whole pot of them, about marijuana. The joint will be jumping with George Dixon and Mario Claudio, who will have you rolling in the aisles. We might even have an appearance by dazzling Dan Furman. That's right. I'm not just blowing smoke. A show with this topic may shock some, but for me, it's high time. All right. Thank you all very much. I will see you soon.